spring lectures of the Vancouver Institute. We don't often run into April, but we do this year. In fact, we have a very special evening for you tonight. And next week, we have a very exciting debate on academic freedom and inclusive university, on perhaps on political correctness in the university or whatever, all of those themes which rouse high emotions. We're not going to have high emotions today, we're going to have facts. But first of all, facts about the Vancouver Institute. You know that many of you have joined the Institute long ago. Some of you have even bought two or three or four memberships. We thrive on those people who really express their affection for the Institute by joining. And for those of you who haven't yet, and probably there are some in this audience, we have our late spring special. If you join the Institute when you leave tonight, then that also entitles you to be a member for all of next year. You don't have to join again or at least you don't have to feel compelled to join again. You can join a second time next year, but the membership holds for all of next year as well. So that's for today. If you join, then you I can proudly come and before 8 o'clock and join the people already members and sit in the front of the room and do that all of next year. And you can put it on your CV. So for tonight, we have Professor Peter Berwin of Simon Fraser University. He came to Vancouver 4 years ago to teach, although he was no newcomer here. He had also taken his PhD here. But he and his brother both joined his brother Jonathan. I think he was here tonight. Jonathan, are you there somewhere? Right. It's actually Jonathan who is the Gordon Shrum professor, I think. That's right. And he is, but they both teach at Simon Fraser University. And Peter, they both came out of London, Ontario. Peter had taught at Dalhousie and Oxford, and also briefly at Toronto. But now he has been here for 4 years teaching in the at Simon Fraser University. And he's going to talk to us today about Newton Online, the electronic revolution in mathematics. I think what he will tell us about is that computers aren't very smart, but perhaps they're smarter than mathematicians. So please give a warm welcome to Professor Peter Berwin.
Thank you. Well, my punchline's been stolen. 4 years ago, as was mentioned, my brother and I came here, and we set up a center at Simon Fraser called the Center for Experimental and Constructive Mathematics. We'd previously tried to do this on the East Coast in Dalhousie, where we were both teaching, and discovered that it wasn't practical to do it there. And we're actually very grateful to Simon Fraser for the flexibility and the vision they showed in allowing us to do this here, or at least over there. And I'm not just saying this because my dean is in the audience. The center's mandate is to explore all aspects of experimental and computational mathematics and the revolution that we believe in, that is taking place in mathematics because of computers. When we set up the center 4 years ago, we believed that we were at the beginning of a period of unprecedented change and growth in mathematics, pure mathematics, and more generally in science. And a lot of this has to do with the coming of age of computers. So this is the thesis of my talk, that we're in a period of very rapid growth and change, and I want to explain to you why. In order to do this, I want to talk a little bit about the nature of mathematics, a little bit about the nature of mathematicians, a little bit about the nature of computers. Four years ago, there was no internet, at least in the sense of the popular sense that the press uses the information highway. The internet revolution has all taken place in the last few years since we came. And while this part of the revolution is going to have a lot to do with, I think, how all our lives change, this isn't actually what I want to talk about, because the effect it's having on mathematics is pretty much the same effect it's having on any other community that is wired. It's a communications revolution. I want more to talk about changes within the discipline, not within the communication within the discipline. When I was asked for a title, I gave three, and they picked one, and I forget which one was picked, but I don't think it was this one. Newton Online Mathematics Comes Out of the Closet. They may stay on these. Everything I'm going to say tonight, pretty much, can be taken off my website, and a whole bunch more of the kind of things that I want to talk about are accessible there. So those of you who are inclined to take notes shouldn't bother. This is a picture of the website. I was going to originally do this whole talk online, so there's an entire online version of this, but I decided to use somewhat obsolete but more reliable technology. Stay. I wonder if there's a fix for this. Mobius.
You probably got it to read those.
Yeah, I was going to. The caption on the cartoon is, the trouble with Mobius is he thinks that there is only one side to every question. Mobius was a 19th century mathematician who, among other things, studied one-sided surfaces. Mathematical humor is somewhat peculiar. you may not find it very funny. So let me really get started on this. I usually tell my first-year calculus students that they're studying mathematics because it's the most important subject there is to study. And I actually more or less believe this. I think life is unimaginable without mathematics. It isn't just that high technology doesn't exist. It isn't just that spaceships and internet technology doesn't exist. Basically, all technology doesn't exist without mathematics. If there was no mathematics, there would be no electricity. 20th century life would not be imaginable. So technologically, we live in a mathematical world. It's been unreasonably successful, mathematics. And the first great successes, I would suggest, well, maybe not the first great success, but the early success dates from Newton. The extent to which mathematics could successfully explain the universe, to which Newton's calculus could successfully be applied to describing the orbit of the moon, for example, some 300 years ago. And in the last 300 years, we have come to trust mathematics, live in a mathematical world, believe that mathematics is correct, whether or not we overtly recognize this. And it's not just mathematics, it's the whole, it's all of science. We live in an age of scientific rationalism, and we can blame Newton for this. So we live in a mathematical world. Mathematics has worked, mathematics has been very successful. And most of us, even those of us who did it a long time ago, have on some level studied a lot of mathematics. We had a lot of years of mathematics in high school. Nonetheless, at any reasonably sophisticated level, mathematics has been arcane and by and large inaccessible. I have some hope that as part of the communications revolution that's taking place with the internet, which is having a democratizing effect on many subjects because the information is just so much more accessible to so many more people, that much of this will change. Now let's see. 50 years ago, I think in January, ENIAC was turned on for the first time. This is a picture of ENIAC. ENIAC was one of the first really successful electronic computers. And as you can see, in fact, this is only a piece of ENIAC. It occupies a large room and probably had the computational sophistication of a handheld calculator these days. I'm suggesting that there's a revolution and an evolution taking place in mathematics. This begins with the advent of computers. On some level, I want to predict the future, which is kind of difficult, so I thought I'd begin by predicting the past. Roughly 50 years ago, shortly after ENIAC had been turned on and had been used by von Neumann. Von Neumann was, for those of you who don't know, is one of the seminal figures of the mid-century in mathematics. I think many mathematicians believe that he was the smartest person who lived this century. And if they're wrong, they wouldn't be far wrong. Von Neumann was involved in many branches of science, but he was involved in the early programming of ENIAC. And he wrote, "It would appear that we have reached the limits of what is possible to achieve with computer technology, although one should be careful with such statements as they tend to sound pretty silly in 5 years. Well, of the stuff that I dug up from around 50 years ago, this was in fact the most prescient, because at least he was right in the last line. A few other quotes from the period and intervening. I won't read them all. But one of my favorite is accredited to Edison. "Fooling around with alternating current is just a waste of time. Nobody will use it ever." If you look back at the places like Newsweek and Time from the late 40s and early 50s, you find articles with titles like "The Great Electronic Brain" and pictures of machines like ENIAC. But if you actually read the text of what was being written, it's very cautious and quite mundane. It says things like, "Computers will never really do things that people can't do. Yeah, maybe they'll be a little bit faster." Of the predictions that I saw, and I looked fairly extensively, nobody was close to right, and nobody was close to ambitious enough in what they speculated. Atkin, who was one of the fathers of numerical analysis, predicted in the 1950, it might be possible to program a machine to beat the stock market. Well, on some level, he was right. You can at least program machines to cause the stock market to crash. So, at the beginning of the computer age, people were not sufficiently ambitious in what they were predicting. And with respect to mathematics, they made very few conjectures, predictions. A conjecture people should have made is computers will solve the full color conjecture. The full color conjecture was solved roughly 20 years ago. And it was really the first significant piece of mathematics that was done with the aid of a computer. I actually want to talk a little bit about mathematics tonight, too. It sort of amazes me that there are 200 people who will come and hear mathematics on a Saturday night. It amazes and pleases me, particularly when they're going to lose another hour out of the night due to the clock change. The four-color conjecture had been around for about 100 years, and it says roughly the following. If you want to color a map, you're a cartographer, and you want to color it in such a way that no two countries that have a common common edge, have a common boundary, are the same colors as a reasonable way to color a map, then you can do it with full colors. And this fairly innocent sounding problem had proved to be very difficult to solve, and it hung around for a long time. And in the, I guess, late 70s, it was solved with the aid of a tremendous amount of computation. Enough computation that I think there's some 20 pages of microfiche in the end of the journal, back of the journal, where the proof is presented. It was the first really major piece of mathematics which was computer-assisted. And at the time, it was quite controversial, and it engendered a lot of discussion about the nature of truth in mathematics. Can you trust something with 20 pages of microfiche computation at the back? That discussion seems to have largely abated. People have got kind of used to this, but when it was new, it was quite controversial. Now, of course, a computer doesn't solve a problem. A computer does a computation. And the four-color problem is, of course, infinite. I mean, there are infinitely many maps. You can check this map. For any particular map, you just try and color it. If it works, you're finished. You move on to the next map. Unfortunately, there are infinitely many maps. So you can't hope to solve this problem by computer alone. It requires a good deal of thought as well. On the other hand, nobody has succeeded in solving this problem by thought alone. It still requires a good deal of computation to solve it. More mathematical humor. The sequence of numbers at the bottom are prime numbers, 2, 3, 5, 7, 11, 13, 17, 19. Out of the numbers, the special numbers, the prime numbers, these are the numbers that aren't divisible by any other number. So 6 is not a prime because it's divisible by 3. 8 is not a prime because it's divisible by 4. Prime numbers are very basic to the study of numbers, and on some level, study of numbers is basic to the study of mathematics. The great unsolved problem in mathematics, the holy grail, at least in pure mathematics, is a problem called the Riemann hypothesis. Dates from 1859 and is, in fact, due to Riemann. And it conjectures really quite precisely how many of the first so many numbers should be prime. Of the first 20 numbers, 2, 4, 6, 8 of them are prime. Makes a very precise prediction about this. Prime numbers are kind of randomly distributed among the numbers. If you look at the individual numbers, it's very hard to decide in general whether or not a number is prime or to predict when the next one will come. But it's possible to predict very accurately how many primes there are out of the first number, sufficiently accurately that if you look at the first billion numbers, the Riemann hypothesis predicts that they should be a certain number, and the actual number only differs by 79. And when you consider that there are 50 million numbers there, this is remarkably accurate. Actually, it doesn't say this at all. This is equivalent to the Riemann hypothesis. What the Riemann hypothesis says is that this particular function should have all its zeros in a particular place in the complex plane. By the way, Scientific American has a rule of thumb that every time they print a formula, they lose half their audience. So, eight formulas should have me down to nobody paying any attention in the audience. Actually, there's a very easy thing to do when you hit a formula in mathematics. You can do what most mathematicians do, you just ignore it. Why am I even bothering to put this on the slide? Because one of the rich things I want to suggest about this Riemann hypothesis is that it's linking two very disparate kind of ideas. Ideas about prime numbers and ideas about complex zeros of a complex function, whatever that means. And the second reason for mentioning it is that it gives you a way, at least possibly, to numerically check whether you think this conjecture should be right. The Riemann hypothesis says that this particular thing should have zeros in a particular place, and you can start computing these things. And people have done that in one of the largest computations ever done at the time it was done, about 4 or 5 years ago. People checked that the first 1.5 billion zeros of this lay in the right place. This was months of extraordinarily difficult computation. If you were a medical person and you thought you had cured the common cold and you had a remedy and you tried it on the first 1.5 billion people and it worked without fail, you'd probably be fairly satisfied that you'd cured the common cold. The question is 1.5 billion pieces of evidence in mathematics? It seems overwhelming. But despite this computation, there are many people who have thought long and hard about this question who don't think it offers any insight whatsoever. Even more obscure mathematical humor. This is a reference, the Bridge of Considerable Difficulty. It's a reference to the Bridge of Asses, which is one of Euclid's propositions. And it was the proposition, unfortunately I forget which one, 14 perhaps, beyond which you were educated if you passed. If you could get past the Bridge of Asses, you could claim yourself to have some mathematical education. It's an amazing thing about mathematics. Euclid wrote a textbook 2,300 years ago, and I would bet that there are still universities in the world where you could take a course out of this textbook. You can still study geometry out of a 2,300-year-old textbook. Euclid's right. It may be not written in a particularly modern style, but you should compare that to the other sciences. I mean, imagine being treated by a physician trained 2,300 years ago, or flying in an airplane on physics that was known 2,300 years ago. The edifice of mathematics is somewhat more solidly constructed, and much of this is thanks to the Greeks, who set down a set of rules roughly 2,500 years ago that we have lived by, rules of mathematical thought on how you construct mathematics. And because they did it really rather well, the edifice of mathematics has been very solidly constructed. We've had to throw away very little because it's wrong. Some of it may not have been useful, but very little of it's really been wrong. This has had an effect on mathematicians. It's made them very conservative. One doesn't want to meddle too much with the structure that's been around and been stable for that long. Let me get back to the Riemann hypothesis. A lot of computation has been done in the Riemann hypothesis. I'm not sure that it suggests much on how to solve the Riemann hypothesis, but I'm going to make two predictions for the next 50 years. Since I haven't really made any predictions yet, I'm currently batting 1,000. My first prediction is that computers will solve the Riemann hypothesis, by which I mean that by computing enough intelligently with the Riemann hypothesis, we will actually learn enough to be able to solve it. I think people now believe that in order to find a solution, one has to find a connection between the Riemann hypothesis and some other part of mathematics or physics. That currently one has to know more about where it lives as a problem than one currently knows. And I'm suggesting that this will happen with the aid of computers. And my second prediction is computers will not solve the Riemann hypothesis. 500 batting average is pretty acceptable. Back to Newton. This is the younger Isaac Newton, probably about the year 1700. This was the 301st anniversary of the publication of Principia Mathematics. This was Newton before he went mad. Newton, the current theory on Newton is that he suffered from mercury poisoning, which is plausible because although he's well known for his physics, he actually spent much more of his life in alchemy trying to turn lead into gold and mercury into gold. And he spent intensive periods, he worked very hard, he was a fairly compulsive individual, locked in a lab with these crucibles melting mercury and stuff like that. And there's a fairly convincing case, I think, made by this man, Clawen, that he in fact suffered from mercury poisoning. He became quite paranoid and had various other symptoms, but one of the pieces of evidence is that they did mercury testing of his hair. It shows high mercury levels. Newton was very strange, very strange man. It takes a certain kind of animus, perhaps, to drive people to that level of performance. For reasons only slightly related to this talk, I was reading the American Psychiatric Handbook of Personality Disorders, and the last entry of the book is compulsive personality disorder. In order to be diagnosed as having compulsive personality disorder, you must meet four of the following five criteria. Restricted ability to express warmth, unduly conventional, serious and formal. Perfectionism that misses the forest for the trees. Insistence that others submit to his or her way of doing things. Excessive devotion to duty and productivity. Indecisiveness, decision making is either avoided, postponed or protracted. It struck me in reading this and having just read a biography of Newton that Newton was easily diagnosable, at least in this sense. But it also struck me that my average colleague made at least 3 out of 5 of these. This is a picture of Alan Turing, who was one of the fathers of computer science, although of course he wasn't a computer scientist because they weren't computers at the time he was being a father. He was also peculiar, but probably not obsessive or compulsive. He is well known for his part in breaking the Enigma cipher, the German U-boat cipher in World War II, and there's a play that has been circulating called Breaking the Code, in a biography of his life of the same name. He's known, best remembered in computer science and mathematics, for Turing machines, which are theoretical computers that allowed him to analyze what could be done by computers before computers were ever built. He's also known for the Turing test, which is a claimed test on how you can tell whether a computer is intelligent or not. He committed suicide in 1954 after a bizarre incident and a protracted period of estrogen therapy, which was given for him to cure his homosexuality as an option instead of going to jail. One of the things that Turing proved in the 30s is this thing I've called a theorem. A theorem is just a fact in mathematics. There is no algorithm that can tell if an algorithm is an algorithm. Well, this is actually a tautology, but it has meaning. You cannot write a computer program that will decide if a computer program works. To be an algorithm, what is an algorithm? An algorithm is a rule for computing something that has to work. It can't just work some of the time. If it's going to be an algorithm, it has to be reliable, i.e. always work. And there's no way of deciding if an algorithm, you cannot write another algorithm. You cannot machine verify that everything you want to do on a computer is actually going to work correctly. This is what this says. This is part of a larger circle of ideas that were developed in and around this time. Gödel is one of the principal players, and certainly one of the seminal intellectual accomplishments of the century is due to Gödel. mentioned earlier that we live in this legacy of Newton, and I think most of us, even though we profess to having doubts about science, actually by and large believe in science pretty profoundly, and believe that science will find the answers. If science hasn't found the answers, it's because we haven't been smart enough. Right? There is a cure for cancer, we just haven't found it. But what Gödel proved in the 30s is that this doesn't have to be true. What Gödel proved is that there must be things that are true which cannot be discovered, which cannot be proved. Out there, they're true facts, the best kind of facts are true, that can never be proved. So think back to the Riemann hypothesis, the holy grail in mathematics. It's a particular statement. It says all the zeros of a particular function lie in a particular place. It's either true or false. Most of us believe in the law of the excluded middle. It's either true or false. I believe that. But what Gödel says is it may be true, but it still may not be provable. There's a third possibility when you go to tackle a problem like this, that no matter how smart you are, you can't prove it. It's true, but it's not provable. It's not provable from mathematics as we know it, or can ever know it in some sense. It's a really very striking fact, and in a way it ought to have more philosophical implications than it's currently had. And if you're interested in reading about that, this is what the book Gödel-Escher Bach that came out, I don't know, some dozen years ago is all about. So, back a little bit to my history of computers. In my world, computers are the legitimate children of mathematicians. In fact, they were built by a mix of people, mathematicians, physicists, and engineers, but of course not computer scientists because they weren't around to help at the time. And interestingly, the kind of analysis that Turing did of computers in large part was done before anybody had successfully built one. Turing already knew many of the limitations of computers, the things that you weren't going to be able to do before one even existed. But the first computers, the ENIAC I showed you, that had substantial computing power, were built during and shortly after World War II. And were very quickly used for all sorts of purposes, but very rarely used by mathematicians. The next 40 or so years, mathematicians, pure mathematicians, in large measure ignored computers. They had spawned them and then they ignored them. They didn't help. And if they did help, they didn't help in an aesthetically acceptable way. There's a famous quote of G.H. Hardy, who was the leading British mathematician of the first half of the century and unquestionably the most influential mathematician politically of that period. Beauty is the first test. There is no permanent place in the world for ugly mathematics. And until very recently, and maybe even still, most mathematicians think that computer-done mathematics is not aesthetically acceptable, but aesthetic standards can certainly change. Even though it's Saturday night, I'm not going to let you off too easy. Picasso wrote, "Computers are useless, they can only give you answers." The most interesting part, I think, of what I have to say, at least to me, is Picasso is wrong, at least with respect to mathematics, and the key to understanding why the face of mathematics is going to change so completely is to understand why he was wrong. It's not that the computers have given us answers, it's that they've given us questions. And I want to talk very briefly about four of them. So I'll start with a little Canadian content. The P not equal to MP conjecture. I've drawn here, crudely, a map joining, a path joining nine cities together. It's an illustration of a problem called the traveling salesman problem. The problem is you have a bunch of cities, presumably far more than nine, but nine will do for the illustration, and you want to find the shortest path joining them. And I've drawn two, the red one, and then the blue is a variation of the red one. And it's plausible that this is the shortest path, but how can you tell whether it's the shortest path? Well, one way to do it is to draw all the possible paths and just see which is shortest. And that's a reasonable strategy, except that there are 362,880 choices of this. Well, you wouldn't want to do that by hand, but that's still reasonable by computer for nine cities, or 10 cities, or whatever there is there. Now, this is a problem that one would actually really like to be able to solve. There are all sorts of situations where you would really like to be able to quickly figure out short routes between multiple different places. Think of airline scheduling, doing all this shipping around that Purolator does late at night, problems like this. Well, the P not equal to MP conjecture very roughly says that this is a hard problem, that it's going to take a lot of computing to do this, not just because we're not smart, but because it's intrinsically hard. Actually, I'm cheating you a little bit on this, but it's a detail I'm not going to worry about. The conjecture was in large measure made by Stephen Cook, who is a professor of computer science at University of Toronto roughly 30 years ago. And what it says is that very many of the kind of problems that you want to solve by computer are difficult. They will take a lot of time. There is no easy way to solve them. Now, this is an example, and this has become a central focus in theoretical computer science, this kind of problem. It's a question that made no sense 50 years ago. Until you were going to solve these problems by computer, there wasn't a conjecture to be made. There wasn't a line of inquiry to be had. Show you a second example. You lose half your audience for formulas. I don't know how much you lose for very large numbers. This is a 200-digit number. Well, relative to the billion and a half I was talking about before, it's actually a small number. But relative to what I want to talk about, this is a large number. This number is not a prime. It has two factors. And you will make yourself $10,000 tonight if you can figure out what those two factors are. What does this mean? Well, you're just trying to find another integer that divides this number. And I'm telling you that there is actually an integer. I know this. There is an integer that divides this. There are actually two. They're quite big. They would both be presumably close to about half the size of the number. If you asked a mathematician 70 years ago or 50 years ago, how do you solve this problem? He or she would have said, it's easy. You just try. Does 2 divide this number? Well, no, it's not even. Does 3 divide this number? Does 4 divide this number? Well, you could skip 4 if you thought about it a bit. Does 5 divide this number? And you keep going, and after a while you can stop because you've gone far enough. The problem is far enough in this means doing 10 to the 100th computations. And 10 to the 100th computations, you would have had to have started before the universe began to have done this, and you still would be nowhere close to finished. Nonetheless, when one was trying to solve a problem like this before the advent of computers, this was the way to solve the problem. This would have been the answer. We knew how to factor numbers. We've discovered that we don't know how to factor at all. We just know far better ways. And it's an extremely active area of research and very interesting area of research in my mind, how you factor numbers. A couple of years ago, this 129-digit number was factored. And I've written down the factorization. This big number equals the product of these two big numbers. There was a character last century called Johann Dace who could have checked this in his head. he could do these level of multiplications in his head. It would have taken him about 8 hours. But most of us can't. It took, and that's just checking, that's not factoring. It took, I think, about 3 months of computer time on a very distributed network, shipped out to computers all over the world in little pieces, to factor this. Well, why should you care about this? You know, who cares? Well, one reason you should care about it is because every time you do an electronic transaction on the internet, i.e. you send your credit card number if you're foolish enough to do that, the security is guaranteed by these methods. The way that information, electronically coded information, is made secure is via codes, and these codes work for the following very simple reason: that I can tell that this number is not prime, but I can't find the factors. If I could factor numbers of this size, I could break all the codes that are shipping all this classified information around from bank to bank, and perhaps make myself very rich, and certainly make myself very unpopular. And in fact, this is you need to be able to factor factor numbers of about size 150. This doesn't much matter. Interestingly enough, this is all intimately tied to the Riemann hypothesis that I was talking about earlier. Ideas that connect together. So this is an example of a question that was solved 50 years ago, and now we're just beginning to understand how little we really know about it. How not to multiply? I multiplied 2 6-digit numbers together and realized when I was doing it that I've more or less forgotten the multiplication algorithm. So you can see the mistake down there. So if you asked anybody 50 years ago, how do you multiply, they would tell you, that's very easy. You do it the way you learned in high school. And it doesn't work badly for numbers of this size. But one of the things we've learned when we've tried to do multiplication of very large numbers on computers is, in fact, this is a horrible way to multiply. It's a disaster. Actually, I can suggest one way it's a disaster to begin with. If you just do it like this, you have to write down all of these numbers. And if you were careful, you wouldn't have to bother. You could just write down this one and then add this one to it, add as you go. And if you think about what that means in terms of memory, you can immediately get rid of a lot of the memory required to doing this calculation. It's too bad that this person, Dace, who could multiply these 100-digit numbers together in his head, isn't alive. It'd be interesting to ask him if he bothered to do this, if he bothered to do anything clever. So what have we learned about multiplication? Well, we've learned that there are very much better ways to do it. And interestingly enough, a good way to multiply very large numbers together rests on the same piece of mathematical technology that allows things like CAT scanners and MRIs to exist, nuclear magnetic resonating imaging, to work. It's called the fast Fourier transform. And the fast Fourier transform is rather nice example of something that many mathematicians believe happen all the time. And that is, fast Fourier transform is a fast way of doing Fourier transforms, if that means anything to you. But it also gives you a fast way of multiplying. And it was discovered more or less as an intellectual curiosity in the middle of the 60s. In the paper by Cooley and Tookie, when they write about this, I think they explicitly say that they don't think it'll have much practical application. The next year, 1966, MRIs were discovered or invented. And they plain and simply would not work without this intellectual curiosity backing them up. So multiplication, another problem we thought we knew how to do 50 years ago. I've hinted that there are better ways to do it. We still don't know the best way. We don't know the right way to multiply. We just know far better ways to multiply. Well, there's something about lecturing after dinner on a Saturday night that makes me go kind of slowly here. You've probably heard mention of fractals and chaos. think it's very rich areas, large areas of inquiry based in and around study of complex patterns, complex looking objects. I don't even see this a bit. The boundary of this is a fractal set, but to compute this picture took some billion computations. And nobody in their right mind was going to try and draw this picture before there were computers. So the whole area in and around fractals and chaos was plain and simply not explorable until one had computers that allowed you to look into these areas. You couldn't do the first examples by hand. Well, if you come and visit our home site on the internet, which you can find by searching on my name, you'll find a card trick, which if I was online at the moment, I would demonstrate to you because I'm pleased with it. It works very well. What does this have to do with mathematics? Well, we put the card trick online because it accompanies a paper that describes why the card trick works, which is actually a fairly sophisticated statistical analysis. It's a statistical card trick. It works most of the time. And it also has something to do with mathematical education. And it gets me to the next prediction I want to make. This prediction I'm totally confident about. The undergraduate curriculum in mathematics is going to change completely. And in my opinion, it's about time. When we put this online, the person who had written the paper was in San Diego, and I dropped him an email late at night and said, you know, get on the internet and have a look. It works pretty well. And I got a message back the next day saying, it works beautifully. We used it in classes today in San Diego. You get to share resources in a totally different kind of way. This is part of the internet revolution. It's not actually why the undergraduate curriculum will be rewritten, but there's a scope for rewriting, a different kind of scope for it. I would suggest that there will be no such thing as a computationally non-adept nations are as bad at balancing bank books as anybody else. And stay away from computation. Most mathematics is about, or much mathematics is about the infinite. And it doesn't lend itself to being computed with, or hasn't lent itself until recently. What I'm showing you here, and you can ignore most of this, is a page of output from a very large Canadian product called Maple that does mathematics better than most of our undergraduates. I'm showing you it doing calculus here. Again, if you come onto our home site, you can play with Maple in situ if you are so inclined. So I'm predicting here that we're going to see in the with the help of sophisticated tools of this variety, and this is a sophisticated tool. I think it's now over 1 million lines of code. It's a large program, large expert system that's very useful to mathematicians. And I suspect to the research part of the community in pure mathematics, these kind of tools that are going to have the most effect. Well, you can't give a talk like this without quoting Einstein. God does not care about our mathematical difficulties. He integrates empirically. On some level, this is what we're learning to do with tools like this. We're learning to do mathematics without having to do it. But you have to trust the answer. In very many situations, if you could divine the answer, you wouldn't have to know why. You only have to know why because you can't divine the answer, because you have to find the path to the answer. Makes a lot of mathematicians rather queasy having to work with tools that they don't totally understand. Mathematics traditionally has not been an experimental subject. Mathematics has been a deductive subject. You've gone from truth A to truth B. And so when you get to truth B, you already have the proof. We do not function, or have not functioned, like other scientific communities have. We haven't, by and large, experimented. But I think some of that's changing, and I want to make a few comments on the experimental nature of mathematics. And I want to show you an example. So this is a formula. This is my first formula. This is a serious formula. It's also, to my eye, a beautiful formula, if you like beautiful formulas. It says that a certain series equals a certain sum of zeta functions. What interests me about this formula, you can more or less forget what it says, is it's true, but it's not yet proven. This is an identity discovered by my brother and some other colleagues at SFU. What do I mean when I say it's true, but it's not proven? For most mathematicians, something is only true if it's proven. And to some extent, that's true for me as well. But I believe this is true. I strongly believe it's true for a number of reasons. First of all, if you check to maybe 100 digits on each side, it agrees. That's reassuring. But secondly, it was experimentally discovered by mining in the right vein of ore. One was looking in the right sort of place for the right sort of nugget and found this nugget. So it's not only computationally plausible, but it's also intellectually plausible. And I am, as I said, certain that it's true. Now, what does it mean to have, I said it agrees to 100 places. One of my favorite quotes on computers. Imagine if every Thursday your shoes exploded if you tied them the usual way. This happens to us all the time with computers and nobody thinks of complaining. Anybody who's worked with computers knows how unreliable they are. They crash all the time. They don't do what you expect. Nonetheless, we do these elaborate computations and we trust them. It's an interesting state of affairs. I'm going to get around to talking just for a few minutes about pi. Pi is one of the few pieces of mathematics that has infiltrated the public consciousness and actually makes Dilbert cartoons. I don't know if you can read this, I'll read it. I spent my entire fortune to buy this supercomputer. What does it do? It can calculate the value of pi to about a jillion decimal places. A lot of people talk about the area of circles, but I'm doing something about it. Remember what pi is. Pi is a number. It's the area of a circle that's radius 1. But it's just a number that begins with 3. I've written down about 500 digits of it. If you didn't see those first 4 digits, which you might know, it would just look like numbers vomited out on the page, which is exactly how it looks. Let me give you another example. So this is now, by my count, my third formula. So a quarter of you are still out there with me, maybe. This is another example of a beautiful formula, in my eye. It says that pi, more or less, the square root of pi can be written as a series. What's beautiful about this formula is that it's wrong. But it's right, if I computed each side of this separately, it would agree to 42 billion digits. This is a serious number of digits. It take you all the way around the world and back, 42 billion digits. You would tend to think that if it agreed to that many digits, it would agree that you had actually discovered truth. But in fact, it goes wrong somewhere between 42 billion and 43 billion. So this is a kind of warning that can't always trust the fact that you have this extraordinary level of agreement. The computation of pi it has been a part of mathematical history for 2,500 years. It goes back to the beginning. And somehow every time there's been a new piece of mathematical technology, people seem to have felt obligated to test it out on the computation of digits of pi. So Newton wrote this somewhere around 1665, 1666. This was Newton's best year. This is when he both invented calculus and invented gravity. I am ashamed to tell you to how many figures I carried these computations, having no other business at the time. One wonders how much free time he had. But he used his newly invented calculus, first off, to compute digits of pi. This is just a little bit of shameless self-promotion. We have a book about to come out on collected papers on pi. It's like a complete parallel history of pi done with two of my colleagues who are in the audience, my brother and Len Berggren. The 400 billionth binary digit of pi is one. If you write a number in computerese, it's a long string of zeros and ones. And what I'm telling you is if you write pi in computerese and you march out 400 billion places, it's one, it's not zero. This is a useful fact to know at cocktail parties. This was computed by this person using idle time on non-workstations. It's a bit like the dog walking on hind legs. It's totally amazing that it can be done. I don't think anybody cares if it's a 0 or 1, but it's totally amazing that it can be done. And it rests on a little discovery we made fairly recently of the following variety. Normally, if one wanted to do these very large calculations that people had done, one needed extraordinarily large computers. If one wanted to work out the 400 billionth digit of anything, one needed to have 400 billion storage locations. Now, that's possible, but unusual. You need the Tokyo supercomputing labs. The little machine on your desk isn't going to do this for you. And what we discovered, and I'll show you on the next slide or two, is an identity that lets us avoid all that memory. It lets us just march out and just pick out a few digits right around this 400 billionth spot, forgetting all the ones that came before. I just can't resist sticking in a moral before I get to this. Remember the Pentium debacle a few years ago when the Pentium chip had to be pulled off because of a fault in the arithmetic in it? Well, that fault was uncovered by a number theorist doing a very large calculation very closely related to the Riemann hypothesis. He's computing something called Brun's constant that has to do with primes coming in pairs. And there's been a long history of these very large number theoretic calculations uncovering flaws. In fact, we've been involved over time in five or six record-setting calculations of pi, and I think in every case we've uncovered some serious hardware or software flaw. Because somehow you push the calculations further when you do this, and they've come to be kind of testbed calculations that people use. That's what the binary digits look like. They look just like a mess. The reds are one and the blues are zero, or maybe it's the other way around. This isn't actually mathematical humor. This is physicists' idea of mathematical humor. So my last identity, I think, the reason that we could do this computation was because we found this identity. We were talking one day over lunch, and about the fact that if we could find just the right kind of identity, a very special kind of identity, we could do this trick of pulling off digits by themselves without having to look at all of them. Only we really didn't have any clear idea of where to look for such an identity. So we spent about 3 months, somewhat systematically, systematically is too strong, but searching with computer and guessing, and eventually found something that simplified to this, which was exactly what we needed. Now, having found this, the proof is a first-year calculus exercise. Trust me, this is a first-year calculus exercise. There's a rule in mathematics that you should have at least one proof. Here's one proof. If we had been told this is the identity, proving it would have been easy. That was not the interesting part of the story. The interesting part of the story was finding it, was searching for it. We simply couldn't have done this without very substantial and sophisticated computational tools. I have the feeling that time is running out. The nice thing about slides is that you can skip them. Skip the mathematics. Stay with the human. It's kind of mathematical experimentation which has paid dividends simply wasn't possible without having a sophisticated computational environment. But we're only really just beginning to learn what it means to experiment in mathematics. Lab scientists have a pretty well understood protocol of what it means to experiment, what it means to present experimental results. We're just learning about this. But I have some hope that it will prove to be an important part of mathematics. So, skipping some of the argument, I'm trying to convince you that much change is taking place. And change sometimes makes people uncomfortable. Russell wrote, change is scientific, progress is ethical, change is indubitable, whereas progress is a matter of controversy. Not everybody likes the directions that are being taken, but I suspect, like with internet technology, too many people are talking with their feet in this. People will just use whatever techniques are available, and those techniques now include substantial computer experimentation and computer-aided discovery. The end of both last century and the century before, there was a period of really considerable pessimism about the state of science, fin de siècle pessimism, particularly in physics and mathematics. There was a belief, an explicit belief, that we knew all the physics that there was to be known. We were really just dotting the I's and crossing the T's. 2 centuries ago, just before the end of the 18th century, Lagrange, who was one of the seminal figures of 18th century physics and mathematics, wrote, "It seems to me that the mind is already almost too deep, and unless we discover new seams, we shall sooner or later have to abandon it. It is not impossible that the mathematical positions in the academy will one day become what the university chairs in Arabic are now." My dean may believe they already have become that way. It had got hard. Mathematics had got hard 2 centuries ago in the places people were looking. One of the things I'm suggesting in this talk, which really is almost over, is that one of the wellsprings of mathematics is becoming it comes from the relationship between mathematics and computing. That computations suggest questions and mathematics suggests computations. But the traditional wellspring of mathematics has been physics. This has been the great driving force of mathematics. And I'm not suggesting that it's going to cease to be that way. But I'm suggesting that they're going to be alternate paths. In this process of change, there are good intellectual reasons for change, but there are also good sociological reasons for change. And in the case of the academy, there are good demographic reasons for change. one-third of my colleagues are scheduled to retire or die in the next 5 years. This is just what happens to the post. The end of the post-Sputnik expansion of universities. And on that very cheerful note, I will finish. Thank you.
We have time for questions, cheerful or not. Yes, Robert.
I'd like to ask you to give a comparison of the quality of education and the use of computers here in the school system, public and private, in British Columbia, as compared with else in the other provinces of Canada and with whatever other countries you can readily make a comparison.
My first response is that what I've seen here is better than what I've seen.
Yes.
Oh, I'm sorry, repeat the question. A comparison of the quality of education with respect to computers here with other environments with which I'm familiar. I think, and I speak more for Simon Fraser because that's my home, Simon Fraser is a little bit ahead of most places. Maybe not comfortably ahead, but a little bit ahead. It's a very hard comparison to make because the world is changing so quickly. So my knowledge 4 years ago from Nova Scotia is so out of date in that 4 years.
Related primarily to the high school system.
My experience there is more limited and restricted to the following. We have a number of high school students who come through our lab on the work experience program that they have to participate in. And they have been very impressive. It's only very peripheral evidence, but if this is what the high school is doing, they're doing it right. The students we've got from them have been very good by and large.
Yes, Morris?
Why did you give the name to your lecture Newton Online rather than Pythagoras Online?
Why did I call it Newton Online instead of Pythagoras Online? Pythagoras would have been beginning at the beginning, and then the lecture would have been even longer.
Back there?
Well, yes, that's right. It predicts how many, and it gives an error. Right? It says there are so many, plus or minus. It does not predict exactly, precisely. There are so many with such and such an error.
And was 79 within the error?
79 is within the error.
So it's an approximate method.
Right.
And an estimate.
But within the fact that there were 500,000 of these, it's a tremendously... It's tremendously close.
Yeah, but the value of 5 was 10 to the 40.
Yes, more. This is right.
Back there?
Is there any way to know how often things are going to be right at 42 million digits or screw up at 43 million?
You have to work really hard to find an example like that. It takes some intellectual effort to make it go wrong like that.
Yeah. Peter?
Can you expand on what the card trick is supposed to do?
Oh, it's a lovely card trick. I should have put it online. The card trick, I wonder if I could explain this in a plausible fashion. I'll try and do this very quickly. The idea behind the card trick is the following. The computer shuffles the deck, and you give me a number, in this case 3, and I go 1, 2, 3, And then I take the card that turns, and I use it to move along the sequence. So that Nace is one, I move one, I then move six, one, two, three, four, five, six, I then move six again. When I get here, I move two, that says six, and I get to the 10. And the computer will have already told you what card you're going to turn up at the end. Right. And it's a card trick. You can do it with a deck of cards. You don't need a computer for this. It's a wonderful card trick, and it's a probabilistic card trick. It's very clever. It works as follows. There is a random input, and that's the first number. But that's the only random input. After that, it's all determined. So if you had given me 3, but somebody else had given me 4 to start, it would have ended up in exactly the same place, because if you'd gone 4, you got to the 6, but it went 3 plus 1 to the 6, got the same place. The reason that this card trick works is that probably, independent of where you start, you'll end up in the same place. For much the same reason that I would bet a very large amount of money that there are 2 people in this room who have the same birthday. Right? The probability of that is extremely high. It can fail. It is possible that there are less than 1 year's worth, as long as there are less than 1 year's worth of people in this room, it is possible that 2 people have a different, that there are no 2 people have the same birthday.
Back there and then here.
Yes, the question is mathematics separating from philosophy as it becomes more experimental? No, probably not. I mean, it probably needs philosophy more to guide it when it becomes more experimental. I find philosophy of mathematics rather interesting, but not very useful. I mean, it makes really no difference to how I do mathematics, although I like reading in the area. Partly because the way of doing mathematics has been so secure that we, at some level, haven't needed the philosophy before, in my opinion.
Why is this lecture called Newton Online? I have the answer. Toward the end of his life, Newton was elevated to the House of Lords. It is reported that he never spoke in the House except to ask someone to please shut the window. And so Timothy Online never really had to speak to anyone.
Other questions?
Yeah? Why do you have more faith in your zeta conjecture than, or identity, than the Riemann hypothesis?
Repeat the question.
Yeah, why do I have more faith in the identity I showed about the zeta function than the Riemann hypothesis? Because the identity is part of a pattern of identities that are plausible, as well as having this large level of numerical agreement, and as well as being found by searching in the right kind of way for it, that would only work if the identity was there. The moment the Riemann hypothesis, I suspect strongly that the Riemann hypothesis is true, but I think there's much more room for, it's such a one-off phenomenon, there's much more room for doubt.
We are using 3 systems, binary, decimal, hexadecimal. Is it likely that yet another system will be developed in the foreseeable future?
Well, if we evolve to having 11 fingers. The question was, we have binary, we have hexadecimal, we have decimal. Are others likely to evolve? And my flippant answer was that if we evolve to having 11 fingers, we'll probably move to base 11. Almost certainly we're base 10 because we have 10 fingers from counting. Possibly. There are other ways of representing numbers, and at times this has been useful. I think for a while Russians were building base 3 computers. It is plausible. I don't think they'll get thrown away. Yes, yes, it's called. That's right. He was giving the right accreditation for the card trick. It's called Kruskal's card trick, after the person who invented it about 20 years ago.
Other questions? Well, let me then
Before I call up Colin Jones to thank our speaker for tonight, let me again remind you of the advantages of joining the Institute before you leave. That your membership is not only going to be helpful to us this year, but you're going to be doing us a double favor, because you're also a member next year. And let me remind you also that next week we have a question about the we have a talk by two people. It's unusual for us, because it's the thing we talked about is relatively controversial. It's academic freedom and the inclusive university, and I think it is going to be a controversial and interesting evening. And that's what we wind up with this year, and so we invite you all to come next week, but come early, because I think there will be a large overflow audience, because we have conference attendees and others coming as well. So buy a membership tonight and then come and sit in the front early. Let me now ask Dean Colin Jones from Simon Fraser University to thank our speaker.
Thank you very much, Eric. I might begin by just correcting one statement that Peter made. He had his colleagues retiring or dying off a remarkably fast rate. Somewhat exaggerated, I think. Now, Peter has just taken off the references to funerals on the overhead, but toward the end of his life, Isaac Newton is quoted as having made the following statement. "I do not know what I may appear to the world, but to myself I seem to have been only like a boy, playing on the seashore and diverting myself in now and then finding a smoother pebble or a prettier shell than ordinary, while the great ocean of truth lay undiscovered before me." This evening, in his very elegant presentation, I think that Peter Borwein has held out for us some remarkably smooth pebbles and some beautifully shaped shells. I'd like to thank Peter for a thought-provoking presentation. I'd like to thank you for being here this evening. I'd like you to join with me in thanking Peter.